from deep inside your radio.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you live long enough, you're going to see everybody on every side of every issue. It's just, at least in the world of politics, because basically that's why we have mainly lawyers in American politics. They're trained to be on every side of every issue. So they're good at it. They're damn good at it. This week, Colin Powell, who previously had been reputed to be less gung-ho for a war on Iraq than Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld, gave a speech, gave a presentation, if you will. He PowerPointed his way through the UN Security Council. And one of the PowerPoints he made was that we now have evidence that Saddam Hussein's Iraq is connected with Al-Qaeda, hence connected with 9/11. Sure, the Al-Qaeda guys are in northern Iraq, which is controlled by the Kurds, which is protected by the U.S. air power, enforcing a no-fly zone to keep Saddam Hussein from messing with the Kurds. Yeah, but there is one, said Colin Powell, there is one representative of the Saddam Hussein government in northern Iraq liaising, thank you very, very much, with the Al-Qaeda folks. So there's your nexus. There's your, it's not even a chawing gun, but it's some kind of weapon. Anyway, that was part of the presentation that Colin Powell made. Now, ladies and gentlemen, we flash forward. That was Tuesday. We flash forward to Friday when the Bush administration announced that, contrary to what astronomers might expect, there's going to be an orange shift to the second highest level of alert for a terrorist act. Now here, voice disguised to protect everyone, is a major network reporter alerting his editors as to the spin the administration was handing him on the heightened alert level.
Okay, now one other thing, and this is quite interesting. The administration is trying to steer us away from saying that the possibility of a military operation with Iraq is a reason that they are raising the threat level. What they're saying to us here is, this is not about Iraq, this is about Al-Qaeda. And we say, okay, yes, but we've been told that there are some intelligence analysts worried that Al-Qaeda could use the possibility of an imminent attack against Iraq as a cover or pretext. And they're saying, no, we're telling you, the possibility of military operation with Iraq is not a factor leading into this. So they're clearly trying to say, you know, don't say that we've created a spookier terror environment by the possibility of a military operation. It's just an interesting little bit of spin we're getting.
It is an interesting little bit of spin. So on Tuesday, says Colin Powell, Saddam Hussein is connected to Al-Qaeda. On Friday, says the White House, messing with Iraq has nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. Two different things. So I think we've got what's known here as a fluid situation. And as with most fluid situations, the best advice I can give you is just don't step in it. Hello, welcome to the show.
Talking a fan. He lives in a high rise. too far behind, just hanging around.
Edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to another edition of Le Show, pre-war. Maybe among the last of the pre-war editions of Le Show, but there'll be many post-war editions, so don't worry about it. So Colin Powell at the UN, ladies and gentlemen. A few extra facts, because you can never have enough facts, don't you think? Especially in this environment, the Guernica work by Pablo Picasso at the entrance of the Security Council of the United Nations has been covered with a curtain. The reason for covering this work is that this is the place where diplomats make statements to the press and have this work, or have had this work as the background. The Picasso work features the horrors of war. On January 27th, a large blue curtain was placed to cover the work. Fred Eckhart, press secretary of the United Nations, said, quote, "It is an appropriate background." Well, I guess he means it is not an appropriate background for the cameras. He was questioned as to why the work had been covered. A diplomat stated it would not be an appropriate background if the ambassador of the United States at the UN, John Negroponte, or Powell talk about war surrounded by women, children, and animals shouting with horror and showing the suffering of the bombings. The work is a reproduction of the Guernica that was donated by Nelson Rockefeller to the UN in 1985. Rockefeller himself has a history of removing artwork. There was a Diego Rivera mural that Rockefeller had sandblasted from Rockefeller Center when he realized that there was a likeness of Lenin in it. Rivera reproduced it later in Mexico City with a John D. Rockefeller likeness, hoisting martini surrounded by ladies of loose habits. Close enough for journalism, ladies and gentlemen. Adlai Stevenson, this is from AP. Adlai Stevenson, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, is shown in the General Assembly Chamber of the UN in New York City in this February 10th, 1965 file photo. President Kennedy sent Stevenson to the UN, where he showed aerial photographs of launching sites for intermediate-range missiles in Cuba during an emergency session of the UN Security Council, October 25, 1965, at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Photographs of mobile biological weapons installations and transcripts of overheard... Pow. President Kennedy was nearly 2 years dead on October 25, 1965, when supposedly, according to this AP caption, he had dispatched Adlai Stevenson to the UN. Probably the correct date is same day... October 25th, 1963. But that's, ladies and gentlemen, close enough for journalism. Colin Powell heralded a British intelligence dossier on Iraq as exquisite. Britain's Channel 4 News has learned that the bulk of the 19-page document was copied from three different articles, one written by a graduate student. Downing Street, the House of the Prime Minister, published its latest paper on Iraq a day before Colin Powell addressed the UN. It gave the impression of being an up-to-the-minute intelligence-based analysis. Powell was fulsome in his praise. The paper outlines the structure of Saddam's intelligence organizations, but it made familiar reading to Cambridge academic Glenn Rangwala. It was copied from an article last September in a small journal, the Middle East Review of International Affairs. Its author, Ibrahim Al-Marashi, a postgraduate student from Monterey in California. Large sections do indeed appear verbatim. A section, for example, six paragraphs long on Saddam's special security organization. The exact same words are in the California student's paper. In several places, the British Prime Minister's office edits the originals to make more sinister reading. For example, they say the Mukhabarat, the main intelligence agency, is, quote, spying on foreign embassies in Iraq. The original reads, quote, monitoring foreign embassies in Iraq. Downing Street was eventually forced to admit, after 24 hours, it made a mistake. A spokesman confessed it should have credited the authors of the articles it used, plagiarized, no, used in the document, particularly Ibrahim Al-Marashi, the graduate student. We all have lessons to learn, said the office of Tony Blair. He himself refused all questions about the dossier as he made a couple of public appearances, trying to win support for his policy on Iraq. In retrospect, said his official spokesman, we should have acknowledged that parts of that were based on Dr. Al-Marashi's work. We all have lessons to learn from this. You know what, ladies and gentlemen? I'm going to go learn some lessons right now.
It's full of lights and all the songs that'll run the night. I got lots of change. Your aim is true. Just press and play. Cause I love the way you slide your shoes in the meltdown boogie. Let me wrap around.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, it is time for an allegedly copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Tales of Airport Security. I have to clarify, I've flown more in the last year and a half than I probably have in any comparable period of my life. And I've been... The only time I've been messed with was when I forgot to remove my wallet from my trousers pockets. And the change in my wallet set off the alarm, and I had to disrobe. But I just want to point out, this feature is not in any way me settling scores. I don't do that. Homie, don't play that. Tales of Airport Security. Corey writes, on Wednesday, I cleared security at Oakland Airport on my way down to LAX for a speaking gig. Oh, you too? When my jacket came out of the X-ray machine, a federal security officer extracted my Colibri butane lighter. She said, oh dear, we can't have this. New regulations, no pressurized butane on the plane. We'll have to drain it of fuel before allowing you to proceed. I protested. Just up that escalator 10 yards away is a gift shop that sells butane lighters. Oh, no, that's not true, the Fed agent said. I guarantee you it is, I said, as her supervisor let all the gas out of my lighter. So I went up the escalator and bought a butane lighter, just like this one, with the name of the airport silkscreen on it, for $2.11. Took it back down to the security checkpoint and showed it to the TSA supervisor. Oh, he said, this is different. It has a smaller flame than your lighter. So I flipped off the windshield and cranked the little valve control lever around counterclockwise and then lit the lighter. A foot-long jet of flame shot out of it. Who does this guy think he is, Jerry Lewis?
No!
Well, he said, the Transportation Security Administration is still getting its act together. We'll harmonize our policies with the gift shops later. For the record, when I ran my jacket through the X-ray at LAX, the TSA guards there didn't say a thing. The lighter was in the jacket. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen. Allegedly a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Settling no scores. Ladies and gentlemen, tell me if this sounds familiar. I believe a story remarkably like this was read on this very broadcast by this very host early in the life of the CD revolution. I think it was about late 1980s when this story surfaced, and I made so bold as to read it to you. And I acknowledge that it turned out not to be true of CDs. Now here it surfaces again about DVDs. Australian investigators, good day, mate, have discovered an increasing number of deteriorating digital video disc DVD product, calling into question assertions by the home video industry that the discs are likely to last a lifetime. Well, you know, some people... According to the Sydney Morning Herald, the failures are the result of corrosion, DVD rot. Yes, there was CD rot was rumored to be rampant back then. And delamination, in which the recorded layer of plastic separates from the base. Quote, some stores have reported they only get two or three rentals from a DVD before it's unplayable, according to Ross Walden, director of the Australian Video Retailers Association. Moreover, the newspaper said, video distributors are refusing to accept returns of damaged discs if the damage shows up following the 90-day warranty period. So, DVD rot. And, you know, it's a growth process. You just have to let some growth occur on the disc, I guess, and that'll... I don't know what it'll do, but I'm just knocked out by the fact that there was this very same story about CD rot back in 89. All my CDs are still playable, so... The other day at the Beverly Hills Hotel, speaking at a panel sponsored by Advertising Age, the Koran of the advertising industry, Jamie Kellner, who denounced people with TiVos or even with VHS machines who used whatever machine's capability to skip commercials, denounced them as thieving magpies, depriving the broadcast industry of the revenue it needed to provide the fine programming that we enjoy in this country. Jamie Kellner, at this conference the other day at the Beverly Hills Hotel, admitted that he has a TiVo. He uses it to watch basketball games quickly and skips through commercials to do so. He's a thieving magpie, ladies and gentlemen. Jamie, thieving magpie Kellner. It's just like when Peter Chernin, of the head of News Corporation, denounced people who were guilty of digital piracy, and then his corporation was revealed to be engaging in digital piracy. President Bush's budget proposal includes $10 million cut for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Uh-oh, call Archer Daniels Midland now. This move could cripple CPB's ability to provide services. CPB President Robert Coonrod stated that CPB can ill afford budget reductions if public stations are to convert to digital broadcasting while continuing to provide content as required by law. Bush's proposal would require any broadcaster using analog spectrum after the new 2006 deadline for digital conversion to pay the FCC $500 million. So, public broadcasting may not make the digital cut. There go those revenue streams, babe. And CNN said this week it has no problem with its lead anchor, Aaron Brown, staying at a California golf tournament, not working last Saturday when the space shuttle Columbia disintegrated. NBC's Tom Brokaw, by contrast, cut short a Caribbean vacation to make it on the air by Saturday night. Peter Jennings, 2 hours away from New York, made it to the studio shortly after noon. Dan Rather was already in New York. Brown was playing golf at the Bob Hope Chrysler Classic in California. He first appeared on the air Sunday night. We don't have to do trains, planes, and automobiles to get our faces on CNN, said a CNN spokesperson. We're lucky to have a lot of stars. Aaron Brown told the Palm Springs Desert Sun that going to CNN's Los Angeles Bureau to work on the Saturday of the shuttle disaster, quote, didn't make sense because I didn't have any clothes, unquote. Brown also said he felt, quote, a profound sense of sadness at what happened. It's horrible. A golf tournament, even a fun one, it didn't matter. It took the fun out of it for me. The CNN spokesperson said a report in the Los Angeles Times that said Brown had told network executives he wasn't available to come to work was untrue. But Brown did say, quote, I sat there and I saw it and I was like, oh man, oh man. The truth is I felt kind of deflated by it all. I was like in two places. This is Aaron Brown, ladies and gentlemen, being quoted. There's a part of me that's trying to figure out if I should fly home now. And that didn't make any sense because I didn't have any clothes. I felt like I was in two places today and it was difficult. More of Aaron's difficulties, as well as the difficulties of another major celebrity profiled by the media this week. Coming up moments from now here on Le Show.
you, it seemed to me, is everything that it should be. Loving you the way I do should be crystal clear to you. You got a thing for me. Even the blind could see something you got. Can't beat it. You got weakens me. I give in like 1, 2, 3. Sometime I do something wrong. We hug and kiss and it's all gone.
Ain't that cool?
You got a thing for me. Even the blind could see something you got. Can't beat it.
Tonight, Barbara Walters brings startling new footage of reporter Martin Bashir at Michael Jackson's Neverland Estate. Plus, the great Aaron Brown talking about missing out on that shuttle disaster story. It's all next on Larry King Live. We're in Los Angeles tonight. Tomorrow, either Connie Chung or I will have an exclusive interview with Lacey Peterson's mother. It's still been worked out. We're happy to welcome back to Larry King Live an old friend. And when I say that, I don't mean that that she's old. Just that she's been a friend of this show's for years. From ABC in our New York studio, the great Barbara Walters. Barbara, welcome back.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Larry.
Gotta say, I don't remember the last time you looked this great. I wish I knew your secret.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, Larry. It's not garlic.
Barbara, you anchored this week's special interview with Michael Jackson. It was just a ratings blockbuster for ABC.
Well, Larry, I've always said, never underestimate the power of a great story.
Mm-mm. What was that like to anchor that show?
It was amazing, Larry. Yeah. Basically, I came in and read the intros and the outros, and then I went to Petrosian for some supper.
Unbelievable.
Well, fortunately, I wasn't paid.
Barbara, I understand you brought some footage tonight that wasn't in the original broadcast.
Larry, this footage wasn't even seen when the interview aired in England.
Where it originated.
That's right.
And it's, now let me see if I got this right. It's Martin Bashir, the English journalist who did
the actual interview with Michael Jackson.
And he's back at Neverland with Michael.
That's right. You may find it disturbing.
Yeah, is there brief language?
Oddly enough, Larry, adult situations.
Okay, Martin Bashir and Michael Jackson at Neverland.
So, Michael, we're back at your bedroom.
Mm-hmm. Notice who isn't here.
Well, your young friend Gavin isn't here.
Mm-hmm, that's right. He's all better. He's gone back wherever.
Did he go back to his parents?
So there's just this big empty bed.
Michael, did Gavin go back to his parents?
I think he was outgrowing me. But look, Martin, look what's on the bed.
What?
You. You're on my bed, Martin.
So I am.
Isn't it great? Isn't it great? And look what else is here.
It looks like a crystal bowl filled with Maltesers.
Mm-hmm. You like those?
Well, I did when I was a child.
But you still like them?
Oh, every once in a
drink. They're all for you. See? Bed isn't nasty. It's about giving.
Well, I know, but I still must insist that I don't feel very comfortable with you up here.
But that's just because we're alone up here. Let's get all the crew on the bed. Come on, everybody. I mean it.
There's our sound man, our producer, our camera person.
Hi.
Your makeup person, my makeup person.
See, we can all fit on here.
What's that remote you've got there, Michael? What does that do?
Oh, this just kills the circuit that the lights are on.
Aye. It gets amazingly dark in here.
Mm-hmm. We're out in the countryside, Martin. And carousel's off for the night.
Mm-hmm. So, Michael, when you're in here like this...
Shh, Martin, no questions.
Well, I know, but...
It's not fair, Martin. You do all the probing. Just relax. Have a Malteser.
Good Lord. Someone shoved that in my mouth like a...
And Martin Bashir reports that the very next morning, there was a $50,000 diamond-encrusted Patek Philippe watch on his wrist.
It's a very powerful story, Barbara. Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that Michael Jackson is upset about the broadcast of the interview. Is he upset also about this footage being shown tonight?
Larry, he may be, or he may be upset about it not being shown before now.
Yeah.
All we know tonight is that only time will tell.
Barbara, there's got to be more to this story, doesn't there?
Oh, there is, Larry. Yeah. This week on a special Wednesday 2020, I interview the sound man.
Now, maybe we can get you back here to talk about that. The great Barbara Walters. And now, in our New York studio, my pal, he follows me every night, but he's not a stalker or a credit collection agency. He's the great Aaron Brown.
Good evening, Larry. And I have to say, before we go any deeper into this broadcast, that I have shared studios with a lot of my heroes in the news business, but never have I shared a lavalier mic and an earpiece with a greater hero of mine than Barbara Walters.
Hey, listen, we should all last so long. Aaron, like me, you like to cover the news, but this week you became the news when you didn't fly home to cover the news. How did all that work?
Well, thank you, Larry, for pointing out the irony that is stared us all in the face this week. Yes, I was playing at the Bob Hope Chrysler Classic last week when the shuttle disaster occurred. It was a lifelong dream of mine to play at this particular tournament, and of course it's also been a lifelong dream of mine to anchor the big stories for a major network.
So you must have been terribly divided.
Well, I'm always terribly divided, Larry. That's kind of normal for me. But yes, this was much more painful. Mm. Almost like having to choose between two of your kids.
Me, I like the youngest one best. Aaron, the story that first came out said that you didn't get down here to the CNN Bureau in Hollywood because you didn't have clothes.
Larry, you know and I know what I meant. I had 3 days' supply of Gary Player shirts and Chichi Rodriguez slacks, and I just didn't think that was appropriate to anchor a story with the solemnity of the shuttle disaster, and you know as well as I do, there isn't a decent men's store within 5 miles of the Bureau. So
you'd have spent a whole Saturday in the limo anyway.
Well, that's the way I saw it. Mm. Of course, in retrospect, I could have sent an intern, if we still had interns. But
you know, there was a quote that you had taken a $13,000 private plane flight to get to the tournament.
Yeah, I know, and I found that profoundly embarrassing. Just the whole notion that I would have sacrificed my journalistic duties for the sake of that kind of expenditure, when you know as well as I do, Larry.
Yeah, yeah.
These tournaments look like recreation, although goodness knows I was anything but relaxed, especially on the back nine.
Oh, it's a killer back nine.
And no, I mean because of the story.
Yeah.
But these events are actually business situations. You're networking. That's, after all, that's the reason for integrating Augusta National in the first place.
And so it's all deductible anyway.
Well, that's right.
So even though Tom Brokaw came back from the Caribbean to anchor the shuttle story...
Well, I was very proud of CNN for pointing out that we don't have just one star at this network. We have many stars, and it was a day for Judy and Lou and Wolf to shine. And Larry, we come to wisdom late and slowly, but... I've learned one thing. I'll never again take a private plane flight without packing a suit.
The great Aaron Brown. We thank him as well as Barbara Walters for honoring us with their presence tonight. On Friday, the entire panel of judges from American Idol. Now, from Los Angeles, good night.
I've never been
Ladies and gentlemen, check my history, if you would. General Norman Schwarzkopf on Meet the Press this weekend on his... No, I really didn't mean to criticize the war tour. Said, well, there are a lot of countries in the world that have nuclear weapons, but the reason that Saddam is so dangerous is because he'll use it. Just check my history, ladies and gentlemen. What's the only country in the world to have used a nuclear weapon in war that we know of? Dateline London, Botox injections and collagen implants have become so widespread in the British film industry that producers and directors are refusing to employ actors who have fallen under the thrall of the so-called pretty poison. Concerned that faces with character are becoming impossible to find because of the growing use of plastic surgery, the film and television industry is attempting to call time out on the Botox fashion. We're forever getting actresses who have had so much Botox that they simply can't move their faces properly anymore, said casting director Paul DeFreitas of the British Casting Directors Guild. We heard this story from American directors a few months ago. The Brits are behind us again. These crazes started in America, but they're coming to Britain in a big way now, said DeFreitas. He believes the use of Botox in particular has increased dramatically in the past year after the injection became a lunchtime procedure offered by the popular drugstore chain Boots. Boots for less than $300. Hollywood directors such as Martin Scorsese and Baz Luhrmann have complained that Botox renders actors incapable of acting with facial expression. Like, is that what was missing in Moulin Rouge? Said Jeremy Zimmerman, a London-based casting director. I had to veto Mickey Rourke for the leading role in a British film I'm working on at the moment and had to explain to his agent that we wouldn't be using him because his face looks so frozen after his recent operations. It's a shame because he would have been perfect for the part, but he just looks so strange now, so expressionless. Says another casting director, Botox has become an extension of the makeup that actors and actresses wear for the camera. The root of the problem, says Michelle Milburn, another casting director, is that there's a huge pressure on actresses to stay looking young, and people do what they think they need to do to get around that demand. It's a tough business. Let's say that again. How do you think I look? No, wait. Let me just... I'll slip out for a moment at lunchtime and then tell me. Speaking of Britain, Britain is to ship plutonium suitable for nuclear bombs by an unarmed ferry service, despite the Prime Minister's campaign against the spread of weapons of mass destruction. It's not a crisis. Tony Blair insisted that the shipments of fuel from the controversial Sellafield nuclear complex should take place, yet security for it is to be cut drastically. This is according to, I believe, the Independent of London, despite the increasing terrorist threat. British Nuclear Fuels, the company that runs the complex at Sellafield, has bought a 16-year-old German dry cargo ferry called Atlantic Osprey. It is to be used to transport mixed oxide fuel, a combination of plutonium and uranium, to Europe. Security experts have warned that transporting the fuel increases the risk of terrorists getting hold of plutonium. Both Britain's Royal Society and the U.S. government have said that if terrorists hijack the fuel, they could extract the plutonium for bombs relatively easily. Oh, and that British dossier, cribbed from an American graduate student's thesis, it was based on 12-year-old evidence. You know, evidence is like wine. It improves with age, as does this copyrighted feature. It's the Apology of the Week.
We're so sorry.
Did I say apology? I meant apologies. A California man received an apology after being convicted of growing marijuana. Ed Rosenthal of Oakland was cultivating cannabis for medical reasons. Medicinal marijuana is legal under California law, but Rosenthal faced federal charges, which override state law, so the judge refused to let jurors hear why Rosenthal was growing more than 100 marijuana plants. Wednesday, five of the jurors who convicted Rosenthal issued him an apology, which does not change the guilty verdict. He faces a five-year mandatory minimum sentence. But the jurors are sorry because the judge didn't let them hear Rosenthal's reason for growing the pot. After more than a year, National Public Radio, they still have that, has settled a simmering dispute and issued a formal apology for suggesting that a conservative advocacy group was involved in the mailing of anthrax to Senate offices. A statement from NPR on February 6th said its January 22, 2002 report on Morning Edition about contacting the Traditional Values Coalition and asking if the group had been contacted by the FBI regarding the anthrax incident, quote, violated NPR editorial principles. Like to have a copy of those, please. The apology, which was published on the NPR internet site, said, quote, NPR deeply regrets this mistake and apologizes for any false impression that the Traditional Values Coalition was involved in this investigation, unquote. The matter has been amicably resolved. John Cleese won his lawsuit that the newspaper's apology for saying he was a flop in the United States was insufficiently sincere. He won about $10,000. Courtney Love, the American rock singer, cautioned by British police earlier this week for throwing a tantrum on a transatlantic Virgin flight, is welcome to fly back to Los Angeles with Virgin after saying she's sorry. She's apologized to the airline's boss, Sir Richard Branson, at a glitzy charity concert. Over cocktails, Love told Branson that she was sorry for misbehaving. Branson says he appreciates the apology and she's welcome to fly with his airline again. Cabin crew had refused to allow a traveling companion from economy to sit with Love in first class. After her release from police custody, Love told reporters she had sworn at a flight attendant. If you're not famous, that wins you a return flight somewhere else. Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina has formally apologized for state troopers gunning down three civil rights protesters during what has become known as the Orangeburg Massacre. We don't just regret what happened in Orangeburg 35 years ago, Sanford said in a statement. We apologize for it. At a memorial 2 years ago, then-Governor Jim Hodges said the people of the state deeply regret the incident, but a spokesman at the time said it shouldn't be characterized as a formal apology. Sanford's apology this week caught civil rights leaders by surprise. Democratic candidates for president in South Carolina are still trying to observe the NAACP's boycott of the state, although Senator John Edwards is appearing at a historic home of a Confederate leader this week. So watch for more apologies from South Carolina. And the office nearby, the office of North Carolina Congressman Howard Coble, is defending his position. No apology yet. He came under fire for comments he made earlier in the week approving the internment during the Second World War of Japanese Americans. It was both for national security and for their protection. So, as I say, we're on the lookout for the apologies to come. The apologies to come is a subsection of Apologies of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Some people simply love to eat raw fish and pay high rent and dance on broken glass. Some people simply love to kill themselves, and sad to say, I think I'm in that class. Alas, your dopey walk, your double talk, I go for that. Your corny jokes, your dizzy folks, I go for that. Your kiss just misses, your dancing is rough, but I like that stuff. I guess I don't get around quite enough. You play the uke, you're from Dubuque, I go for that. And furthermore, I just adore your fuzzy hair, your vacant stare to Mr. Cupid, I take off my hat. You can't account for silly taste, of all the hearts I could have chased. I look at you and ooh, I go for that. Play the uke, you're from Dubuque, I go for that. And furthermore, I just adore your fuzzy hair and your vacant stare. To Mr. Cupid, I take off my hat. You can't account for silly taste of all the hearts I could have chased. I look at you and ooh, I go for that. I go for that. Ooh, I go for that.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, speaking of history, this program is going into that bin, at least this week's edition thereof. That concludes this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, and around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network. On shortwave, WBCQ The Planet, 7.415 megahertz. Across North America, the vast sweep of North America via Sirius Satellite Radio. And on your computer around the world whenever you want it. Whenever you want it at two different locations, www.harryshearer.com and www.kcrw.com. And, you know, it would be just like always packing a suit on a private plane if you'd be willing to come with us then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. The email address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. That's also the address to sign up for the supposedly low-impact newsletter. It'll be fine. We're working it out. The Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of SAS, a satellite service of KCRW Santa Monica. It's a community known around the world, ladies and gentlemen. Think of it as the home of the homeless.